Our next case this morning is United States against Sims. Mr. Dana.
May it please the court, my name is David Dana. I'm counsel for Don Sims. Mr. Truitt is counsel for Mr. Lambertson, and we're going to divide our time. The issue in the Sims appeal is the question whether the court abused its discretion in its response to a specific jury question. The jury question, in effect, asked whether the intent standard for substantive mail fraud was higher or different than the intent standard for conspiracy. It was quite a specific question. Our argument, in essence, is that the district court failed to respond with adequate specificity or adequate direction in such a way that it may have led the jury to believe that the standard was lower, the intent requirement is lower for conspiracy to commit mail fraud.
The instruction itself was taken from the pattern criminal jury instructions prepared by the committee of the Seventh Circuit.
That's right, Your Honor, and we're certainly not making the broad argument that the pattern instruction is per se unconstitutional, but when a jury comes back with a specific question, in fact the judge said it was the most specific question he had received in 26 years, that says we're confused about how to put together the intent standard for conspiracy and substantive mail fraud, then I think the court is aware, the district court, that there's a problem or confusion and needs to respond if this court is set.
Well, very frequently juries will ask for additional instructions and the court will simply respond, read the instructions you've got. In this case, they went farther. He read and she gave him an instruction, which was agreed by everybody except your client, that met the standards of in addition to consider it's not any better or more important than any other instruction, read them all together again.
Well, again, Your Honor, we're not arguing the instruction is per se unconstitutional, but juries vary, and in this particular jury, they expressed confusion about how to read
these.
The question is whether
correcting that confusion was appropriate the way it was done.
And our argument is that it was not.
Okay.
That's not a very broad holding in the sense that we're not attacking either the idea that you can't have inconsistent verdicts.
Well, I recall correctly that the trial court felt that the instruction you tendered didn't properly state the law on the subject.
That may be true, but it's quite clear. In fact, if you go back to Scarborough, a 1993 case in the Seventh Circuit, this court has said that the intent standard for conspiracy to commit an offense isn't any lower than the intent standard to commit a substantive offense.
Well, you can read all these instructions together and you come to precisely that conclusion.
Your Honor, that's correct, and that's why the instructions on their own, if the jury hadn't come back, would not be objectionable.
Including the one that was given.
Yes, but the jury read the instructions and, in fact, through the specificity of its question, indicated it read them with great, maybe even unusual care, came back and said, we don't understand this. Is this the same standard? And in that case...
I used to instruct juries at great length, and I didn't understand it. But what we were trying to do was prove to the Court of Appeals that at least the trial judge understood the instruction. But this seemed to be almost a model of clarity, the instruction, and it cited the law as it exists.
Well, Your Honor, the jury asked a very specific question, which is the intent standard, and the results suggest they thought there wasn't adequate intent for mail fraud, is the intent standard for conspiracy somehow lower? Do we have to, if we don't find intent for mail fraud, does that mean that what we should do, with conspiracy? It was a very specific question, and there's a very specific answer under the law, which is the intent for the substance offense has to be there if you're going to convict on conspiracy.
But what you ask for would put a greater burden on the government than is required, and that's not the appropriate way to do it.
There are two distinct questions here. First, you kept referring to higher or lower. I'm not sure I understand what that is. But the proposition you're just making, that in order to be guilty of conspiracy, you have to intend to commit the substantive crime...
No, but the level of intent... In Scarborough, this court said, to prove intent to commit conspiracy, the prosecution must show that the defendant possessed the requisite intent to commit the underlying crime. And I think what the court meant there is that there's a sense of kind of...
That's unduly favorable to the defendant, right? One can conspire to commit bank robbery by agreeing to help the bank robber, even without any intent to go rob the bank yourself. Think of the driver of the getaway car.
But there has to be an intent.
So there's no intent. One can be guilty of conspiring to rob a bank without having any intent to rob the bank. perfectly.
For example, Your Honor, if someone accidentally helped a conspiracy, they sort of accidentally, they weren't thinking about the underlying objective or the end result of a criminal enterprise, it would be very hard, I would think, to make an argument that they would be culpable for conspiracy, because there has to be a level of intentionality.
And very little to connect them to the conspiracy. That's one of the problems that the defense constantly faces in defending against conspiracy.
Well, Your Honor, the question of how to talk about intent, I admit, is not an easy one to correlate between conspiracy as a whole is not an easy area. But this court has said that, and other courts have said specifically, intent to defraud is required for conspiracy to commit mail fraud. Other circumstances, there's no, I've looked everywhere, no case law to the contrary. And this court has said that a kind of intentionality for conspiracy has to be there that is of at least, and again, I'm not saying it's clear exactly how to do it, of the same kind of level as in the underlying offense. And I think that's exactly what the jury was trying to get at. And if you look at the end result, it does seem that there was some confusion, because here this court, the only issue is intent, whether basically Sims knew that he was getting involved with something that was really illegitimate or wrongful. The jury acquits on a whole series of mail fraud counts.
I understand you.
And then when it gets to the conspiracy count, it convicts, suggesting that it didn't have to, it was assuming that Sims could act with completely benign intent.
I think the court is aware of your argument on that matter and what you have in mind.
All right, Your Honor.
So, from your position, just this last statement you made, that would be the actual prejudice. Let's assume that it was error for the court not to just answer the question yes. So, your position would be that when you look at the acquittals on the other counts, that was really the actual prejudice in the court not answering?
Yes, well, I think that...
And do you think that that's the standard we should apply?
I think that... I think that when you look at whether something had actual prejudice or harmless error, you have to look at the whole circumstances of the case. And here, one of the things that is informing of that is how the jury came back, how they came back in terms of the acquittals. I think if you didn't have that, it might be harder to make the argument or the conclusion that it was a prejudicial error. Do you have anything further? Well, just... finally, and this isn't directly on point, but to go back to the intentionality question, because it doesn't go to the question of the jury instruction, just one thing I'd point out is, you know, Mr. Sims did...
You're on Mr. Truitt's time.
I'm on Mr. Truitt's time. Well, I would just point out I'm on Mr. Truitt's time there. Let him go.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Truitt.
May it please the court, the defendant David Lambertson specifically joined in the question of the issue raised by Mr. Sims in his brief.
A little hard since you expressly agreed with the instruction.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But we called waiver.
Though we, in retrospect, we feel that clear error was made.
No, there's no clear error test after there's a waiver. Waiver just ends it. The clear error test, plain error test actually, is for forfeitures, where you just stand silent. But there was no silence in the district court with respect to Lambertson. This instruction was agreed with.
Then that, if the court finds that Mr. Sims' argument is well taken, and reverses as to Mr. Sims, I think that would produce a terribly unjust result, and it would put...
That's what often happens with waivers. One defendant pleads guilty, the other defendant pleads innocent, goes to trial, and is acquitted. The first defendant rues his choice.
I don't think that is an analogous situation, but I would like to move on to the other issues that I have raised. Specifically, we have raised three enhancements that the court determined existed pursuant to the United States sentencing guidelines in increasing Mr. Lambertson's sentence. The first one was vulnerable victim. And though we raised the issue of whether these individuals were vulnerable in our brief, in my argument I'd like to focus on the requirement, the co-requirement of the sentencing guideline, that Mr. Lambertson knew or should have known And we contend that there was no evidence on this issue presented to the court that David knew or should have known, even stretching the should have known requirement. There was no direct solicitation by Mr. Lambertson of any of the investors, which is significantly different than a lot of other cases where the fundraisers or the person who is conducting the fraudulent scheme either directs an advertising toward a large group that he would that he knew would be vulnerable, such as Vietnam veterans, as raised in this case, and there's no evidence of that. There was some contact throughout the course of Mr. Lambertson's tenure, but that would stand more to the fact that they are sophisticated and not vulnerable because they are calling as to where's my money or how is it going to be paid back, and I'm not sure if that supports an issue of finding of vulnerability. The second is the obstruction of justice issue, where the district court specifically found that David Lambertson testified falsely when he stated in an answer to a cross-examination question that he told Dixie Grinnell that this investment was risky. The court based its finding that Dixie Grinnell's testimony was more truthful than David's testimony by looking to the fact that she continued to write investment notes and continued to use the old form. The district court totally failed or ignored to consider the impact of the testimony of Mike Klein, who was a cooperating co-defendant. Mr. Klein was very specific in his testimony concerning conversations that he and Mr. Ballinger had with Dixie Grinnell and her brother early on in these proceedings, where they made her aware that there was no security for these investments. And she was aware, they were of the opinion that she was aware of the true financial condition of this organization. He also went on to reveal conversations that she had or conversations she initiated about getting commissions or additional commissions, and their primary concern was getting their payment, and they even broached the subject that they should get a renewal commission if people renewed or allowed their notes to roll over for another 9 months. And I think when you examine this in the true context of the motivation for Dixie Grinnell, it shows the erroneous conclusion that the court reached, in that when you look at these, when you base your decision solely on the fact that they continued to write notes or continued to use the old forms, that was sufficient to show by a preponderance of the evidence that Dixie Grinnell was correct and David not only was incorrect but was intentionally falsifying his testimony. The third issue, the third enhancement, was based on an abuse of trust. The abuse of trust doctrine is based on a number of different ways that a person would be in a relationship of a position of trust. One is the classical fiduciary relationship, lawyers, doctors, and the others would be in situations where...
Let me just stop you there. So you want us to say that Lambertson, who was serving as the president and had complete managerial discretion over the funds entrusted to him, doesn't qualify for an abuse of trust? Where a person in that like circumstance, where the court is so found,
he had the position of president. I don't think he had the authority of president.
And he certainly had authority over the funds.
No, he didn't have total authority over the funds. Pat Ballinger continued to maintain a bank account in his wife's name. If you look through the testimony, he kept the checkbook in his car. His wife would not reveal the balance. David Lambertson had to set up a separate account without Mr. Ballinger's name so he could have some control over the finances. Money continued to be deposited in this account solely maintained by Ballinger and his wife. So he had a title, but he didn't have total authority and total control. The decision, even Mr. Ballinger, who was another cooperating co-defendant, acknowledged that the purchase of Genesis stock was in an attempt to provide a fund to secure the investors. That goes more to the issue of the second part of the issue. Did he abuse the position of trust? And we think even a stronger argument, even the court finds that there was a position of trust, that there was no abuse of that position of trust. The steps that David Lambertson and everyone who testified was unanimous that David Lambertson was attempting to run the business in a proper way. He was trying to make it profitable so the investors could get their money back. Even the lower employees were saying, of all the employees, of all the persons that were part of Genesis or part of Dealer Direct, that David was the only one they could trust. David was the only one they could go to. We think that...
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. King.
May it please the court, counsel. Lavita Morris King on behalf of the United States, the appellee. I was not trial counsel below, however. Counsel for the appellant Lambertson pointed out in his appellate reply brief regarding a government's incorrect typographical error regard to the date that the business floundered. And counsel is correct on that. That was a typographical error. Cited in the government's brief was December 1997, correctly put and cited by defense or appellant counsel is December 1998. However, appellant's argument is still flawed. While appellant Lambertson wants the court to believe that he did not solicit or receive any funds from any investors, quite clearly the record reflects that in April of 1999, Mr. Lambertson's signature is on a promissory note that was issued. With respect to the jury instruction, as the court already noted, the court did supplement the instruction with a standard Seventh Circuit conspiracy instruction, to which I would add that there was no objection by either defendant at that time to the initial court's instruction on conspiracy. The court also, the lower court also took great pains to not highlight that particular supplemental instruction by pointing out to the jury that it should look at the entire instructions as a whole. The court did this at the beginning of the supplemental response or instruction and again at the end.
Well, if the judge had just answered the question yes, is it your view that the instruction would have elevated the government's burden? And if so, how?
Not quite sure if it would have elevated the court, the government's burden, Your Honor. However, I would say that, and I think the court looked at this in Adcock's case, by simply answering the question yes or no, it could have been even more confusing to the jury to just do that and not probably accurately reflected all the circumstances involved in the situation. Looking towards Mr. Lambertson's sentencing issues, one, the first one being obstruction of justice, the two-level enhancement under the guidelines under 3C1.1, the district court did properly apply that two-level enhancement. The court, lower court, did recognize that Mr. Lambertson testified about Ms. Grinnell telling her, tell your investors this is risky. The court found that this to be central to the case and also found Mr. Lambertson's testimony to be intentionally false. With respect to the vulnerable victims, the two-level enhancement applied to Mr. Lambertson. The court recognized that of the 34 victims, 27 or 79% were over the age of 70, and I believe that's about 79%. Also that the victims were unsophisticated financially or unfamiliar with some of the documents in respect to those that they were viewing. Also recognized by the lower court, I believe there was testimony by one of the cooperators that these victims were an easier sale, and again, less sophisticated. Referring now to Mr. Lambertson's two-level enhancement under the guidelines under 3B1.3, abuse of trust, again recognizing that there is a two-prong test. First, whether Mr. Lambertson occupied a position of trust, and secondly...
Is it your position that Lambertson sold any of these investments directly to investors?
I don't believe that the record bears that he directly solicited any of the investors.
Well, if he didn't directly solicit the investors, what was the abuse? I understand from cases like Maybrook the idea that giving somebody with a high title may be able to put himself over on investors more easily, but that doesn't seem to be the theory here. But ordinarily, don't we think of the abuse of a position of trust as abusing the trust to harm the victim? But here, the position of trust is in Genstar, in the issuer, and they aren't the victims. The victims are the investor. And there was no position of trust, apparently, via the investors.
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that Mr. Lambertson did have a position of trust. As pointed out
no,
by
that's,
the court...
No, that's not the question I'm asking, right? I have a position of trust via the people of the United States. Suppose I rob a bank. I just go into the bank, pull out a gun, stick them up. Do I get a two-level enhancement for abuse of a position of trust just because I was, before I robbed the bank, apparently a trustworthy person, had a position of trust in the judiciary? I think the answer is no, because I didn't abuse that to harm the judiciary.
Well, looking toward the facts of this case, Your Honor, and using Maybrook as an analogy, I believe that Mr. Lambertson was involved in the day-to-day operation of the business.
Yes, but the business is not alleged to be the victim. See the thing that worries me, that the normally an abuse of the position of trust is you have a position of trust via the victim and use that to work the injury on the victim. The lawyer fiduciary embezzles client trust funds. He had a position of trust via the client and he used it to injure the client. The question I'm asking here is, how did Lambertson's position of trust via Genstar, how was that used to injure the victims?
Well, Your Honor, I believe there were instances when the victims would call in and, excuse me, Mr. Lambertson would, in an effort to console and lull the victim into believing that their funds or monies would be returned, made certain representations to those victims. And in that, he played sort of a delay or stall tactic, and he was able to do that because of the position that he held, and the investors looked to him for that.
Well, wasn't that one of the specific findings of the district court, that he mailed misleading statements to perpetuate the conspiracy, that he employed his position to deter investors' inquiries, to conceal the scheme, saying to investors that their money was fully invested or would shortly be returned to them?
Yes, Your Honor, that is some of the lulling type statements that he did use to some of the investors. Correct.
And when he advised these investors, they were aware of his position.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor.
And some of these were letters, actually written communications to investors, or was it all by phone?
I'm not certain of all the communications, Your Honor. The ones that I'm aware of can speak to the court or address the court today would be via the telephone. And so, based upon representations that Mr. Lambertson made, again, we believe that he did have that abuse position of trust and that he did abuse that position. And unless the court has any other questions, we would ask then that the court affirm the decision of the district court.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Mr. Dana, Mr. Truitt, we extend our thanks to both of you for your willingness to accept the appointment and the assistance you've been both to your client and to the court. Thank you very much. The case is under advisement.